You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, it's Ben Mathis here with just a quick favor to ask. We love having great advertisers support the show, but in order to continue doing that, we need your help. So please go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that'll help us get to know you a little better. That way we can show advertisers just how enthusiastic our audience is about Kick-Ass News and keep the show free for listeners like you. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, and it's really important that we have lots of listener feedback, so I'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to fill out this new one. Plus, as a thank you, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and thanks for listening. Today's podcast is sponsored by Nadex. Do you want to try day trading the markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See for yourself why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. When I was a boy, the sound of a clock ticking always delivered the bittersweet news that the weekend was winding down and another school day was coming. But for the adults in the room, that same iconic tick-tock of an Aristo stopwatch drew their attention to the TV in an almost Pavlovian way, promising an hour of the very best and most thought-provoking television every week. CBS 60 Minutes, the serious-minded, no-frills program that all but invented the TV news magazine format, was and still is the gold standard of broadcast journalism. With probing interviews of heads of state, thought leaders, and the occasional celebrity, and meticulously researched and uncompromising exposés of corporate greed and political corruption. But lest they bring the audience down too much, 60 Minutes always capped things off with the tongue-in-cheek and slightly rambling polemics of the lovable curmudgeon Andy Rooney, who became something akin to America's grouchy uncle. 60 Minutes was created for CBS by legendary newsman Don Hewitt in 1968, but initially the network had little confidence in the show, sticking to the long-held idea that primetime news shows always lost money and were only good for prestige, not ratings. But 60 Minutes quickly found its audience, breaking into the Nielsen Top 20 in 1976 and staying there ever since, making it the most successful program in U.S. television history. It spent a record 23 seasons in the top 10 ratings, and for five of those seasons, it's been that year's top program, a feat matched only by All in the Family, The Cosby Show, and American Idol. And with an unsurpassed 138 Emmy Awards and 20 Peabody Awards, 60 Minutes is proof that television doesn't always need to appeal to the least common denominator to make a hit. Now beginning its 50th season, 60 Minutes has been home to some of the most renowned names in broadcasting, including Mike Wallace, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, Morley Safer, Ed Bradley, Diane Sawyer, Charles Kuralt, Bob Schieffer, Steve Croft, and Leslie Stahl, who now embarks on her 26th season as host and correspondent of 60 Minutes, with a dozen Emmys and an Edward R. Murrow Award to her credit. Today, Leslie joins me on the podcast to celebrate 50 years of 60 Minutes and share some stories from her own 45 years at CBS. She'll explain why she likes to say she was born on her 30th birthday. She'll reveal how being a woman actually helped her get hired by CBS and share how the young reporter scooped the other networks and became the first to break the Watergate scandal. She'll recall her impressions of the three presidents she covered as White House correspondent for CBS and her frustration with some of the less than forthcoming guests she encountered during her 8 years as host of Face the Nation. She'll discuss her quarter century as host and correspondent on 60 Minutes, including what she noticed in her first post-election interview with Donald Trump, the incident when Nikolai Sarkozy stormed off in the middle of a taping, and the time she pissed off an angry, drunk Boris Yeltsin. Plus, she shares fond memories of Don Hewitt, Mike Wallace, and Andy Rooney. Coming up with 60 Minutes' Leslie Stahl in just a moment. Today I'm joined by Leslie Stahl, who is one of America's most honored and experienced broadcast journalists. She's been a 60 Minutes correspondent since March 1991. This Sunday, September 24th, 60 Minutes returns for its 50th season and Leslie Stahl's 26th season on the broadcast. Leslie Stahl, thanks for coming on the podcast and congratulations on that anniversary.
What an introduction. I guess I've been there slightly more than half the time. I hadn't thought of it that way, really.
Well, you've pretty much spent your entire career at CBS. I've heard you say that you were born on your 30th birthday, which coincided with that moment when you joined the network, right?
It's actually, truthfully, the day I became a reporter. I had wanted to be one. It took me many years, and I was finally, the egg finally cracked, and I hatched on the day I became a reporter. And I was actually working in Boston at the time. I don't want to say I was a veteran by the time I got to CBS. I was as green as they come.
So that was really the beginning of your education as a journalist when you arrived at CBS?
No, it was the beginning of my life. I literally was born on my 30th birthday.
Prior to that, you were working in local television in Boston, which isn't exactly some tiny little backwater, is it?
No, it was a wonderful job. I loved it. Boston is one of the best cities for journalists because it has the universities, it's the state capital, it has great medicine, it has unbelievably terrific politics. Yeah, I love that job. But the station I worked for went off the air. And at that very moment that I was wondering, what am I going to do next? A friend of mine in New York actually worked at CBS, called me up and said, since affirmative action passed, the networks are desperate to find women and minorities with any experience, and you should apply. So that's what happened.
Yeah, you called yourself an affirmative action baby, right?
Right, exactly.
And I think I read that you came up with some other affirmative action babies, Connie Chung and Bernie Shaw.
Bernie Shaw. The three of us were hired around the same time to work in the Washington Bureau at CBS, which was a wonderful place to work at that time. I remember the first time I walked in the newsroom and the offices of the senior correspondents were like Saks Fifth Avenue windows. There were no doors on them. And there was Marvin Kalb and Roger Mudd and Dan Rather and Dan Shore. And I said, oh my God, I'm going to work here. And then they gave Connie Bernie and me, I'm not making this up, little children's desks in a corridor. So, hello, welcome to CBS News. But I, at least, was just thrilled to be in the door. Yeah, I was.
So you have a totally different experience from those women who talk about how hard it was to break into network news back in those days. In your case, it actually worked in your favor.
Totally worked in my favor. I think the women who talked about the difficulties probably also benefited in getting hired. Mm-hmm. But once there, they came to realize that they were being paid less for doing the same work as a man. And that was an issue with CBS News as well. And at that point in journalism, women were not being given the top kind of assignments. And that did not happen to me. I had a wonderful boss who was committed to helping the new reporters, because the three of us really were inexperienced in terms of CBS correspondence, what they were expecting. And so they had an apprentice program, and we were kind of a level below. And it was wonderful because we got to make our mistakes, and we followed the senior correspondents around and learned basically how to do the job.
And that must have been an exciting time to be at CBS, because unlike now, when to some extent the network news departments have leveled out, in those days there was CBS and then there was NBC and ABC competing for a distant, distant second. Did the influence of broadcast giants like Edward R. Murrow and Bill Paley, Fred Friendly, still loom large in those days at CBS?
Oh, absolutely. Fred Friendly was still alive. Mr. Paley was very much alive. Frank Stanton was president of CBS. And it wasn't that long after Morrow. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think some of the senior correspondents had been hired in his era. So very much this idea that we were, I don't want to say the New York Times of television, but that we were the top network, not just because of audience, but because of the quality of the journalism as well. And that's probably why I was so happy. I was on a cloud. I'm not kidding. And I was very much a number two, but it didn't matter. But as time went on, it did matter to me and all the other women. We began to feel like, why are we second classes? And in some news organizations at that time, the women actually sued. It didn't happen at CBS.
How did you earn your respect as a journalist, as a woman at CBS?
Did I?
Or did you feel? I would hope so by now. You've got 12 Emmys.
I'm not sure. I think that it wasn't that they had plucked us up and thrown us out and said, you know, sink or swim, and here you have the big story of the day. And if you don't do a good job, you're never going to be able to do it again. They brought us along. And it took years. I know that in some affirmative action cases, people were hired and thrust into positions that they hadn't done all the baby steps that you need to do to get there. But we all did. Bill Small, who ran the Washington Bureau in those days, was committed to this program to make it work for us.
And you made your bones covering the Watergate scandal. When the Watergate burglars got caught, you managed to scoop all the other networks on that story. How did you do that?
Well, when the break-in occurred in June of 72, I was the new correspondent. This was the middle of that 72 political campaign, presidential campaign. And virtually everyone in the Bureau who didn't have a beat, like the White House or the Pentagon, was assigned a candidate to go out and follow. And no one really thought this break-in was anything other than a local burglary. But it was the Democratic Party. And I remember the assignment editor looked around the newsroom and said, hey, kid, go cover this arraignment. And I and a reporter from the Washington Star, which was a local Washington newspaper, and he was one of the metro reporters. He wasn't a national reporter. And a guy from the Washington Post and I were the only three people outside of the burglars and their lawyers in that courtroom, and of course the judge. And I turned left and met Bob Woodward, and he too was Metro. It was not in the beginning considered a story, really. I'll bet they didn't even write about it in the first day. But we kept going back to that courthouse, and suddenly we realized that they have $100 bills and consecutive numbers. They had phony passports. One, they were working for the CREEP, the committee to reelect the president, President Nixon's campaign. So slowly it became clear it wasn't such a small story. And Woodward used to say to me, never let them take this story away from you. You hold on to this story as tight as possible.
And weren't you living at the Watergate at that time as well?
I didn't have far to go to cover it.
And what was the mood like in Washington as the Watergate story snowballed when it broke?
Oh, my goodness. You can't imagine. It was the height of adrenaline flow was so enormous that just breathing, you know, got you into a high. When I say everybody, I mean the entire journalistic world and the entire government world. And it just everybody, except maybe, you know, storekeepers and psychiatrists, were on high alert, focused on this story. People would fly in, celebrities would fly in from California, movie stars, to just come and sit in the Senate caucus room when the Senate Watergate hearings were underway. We had heads of state from other countries come and sit in that room. It was enormous, and of course it was televised every day, live. Mm-hmm. People around the country were fixated on this. And the question was, what did the president know, and when did he know it? So it kept everybody riveted. It was a mystery. It was a mystery story.
And that led to you being hired on as the White House correspondent for CBS. You were there through three administrations. Just briefly tell us a little bit about your impressions of those three presidents.
Well, the remarkable thing to me was how different each one was and how quickly their personalities were absorbed by the country. It was very interesting. So my first one was Jimmy Carter. And he was a very, very religious man, and he worked round the clock. And there was high tension. Every day was a crisis. Every day, the lights burned, you know, till 3 a.m. And the country was tense. You know, we were all like that. He made his concerns the country's concerns. Mm-hmm. And then the next one was Ronald Reagan, much older, had already absorbed the idea that this too shall pass. He calmed everything down, including the country. He never stayed, the White House never stayed up till 3 a.m., unless there really was a genuine crisis. And then, of course, George Bush, the first, came in, and he was, let me say, sane. Sane and easygoing. And I think the country absorbed the bit of his laconicness, if that's the right word.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because I often hear pundits say that the president reflects the mood of the country, but that's the first time I've ever heard someone say the country reflects the mood of the president.
Presidents can, through osmosis, I don't know, through magic, infiltrate down to the level of people on the street. Mm-hmm. They convey their own concerns to us.
And I think you said that of all the presidents, George H.W. Bush was the one that you enjoyed the most on a personal level. I believe you said he has kind of an everyman quality or a down-to-earth quality that you appreciated, which is surprising because his big problem as a politician was always this popular perception that he was some kind of out-of-touch Yale blue blood who people couldn't relate to.
When I say I don't think I ever said everyman.
Okay, I'm paraphrasing.
He was not an everyman. But he had a great sense of humor. He was one of the presidents who got up out of the Oval Office and walked around. He used to walk around down into the press room just to say hi. He was sociable. He had an impish sense of humor. and he smiled a lot, and he liked to have jokes going on. Jimmy Carter never left the Oval Office, and he was working, reading, and discussing. He's like a professor. And, you know, the press secretary also reflects the nature of the president. So when Jimmy Carter was in the Oval Office, his press secretary used to brief us. It was almost like a seminar in college. And Reagan came in. He was a reader. He was not known as someone who stayed up all night, poring over documents. And the press secretary's briefings were very thin. We really had to push to get information and to be educated. And then George Herbert Walker Bush was somewhere in the middle. He was sane. He didn't have, strange personality traits, quirks. He didn't have them.
You were actually at the Republican convention in 1980 when you broke the news live that Ronald Reagan had chosen him as his running mate instead of Ford. And wasn't George H.W. Bush within earshot of you and sort of sulking because he thought he had lost the VP spot?
The second half of your question didn't happen.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from. But yes, in 1980 at the Republican convention, Walter Cronkite, our leader at CBS, and I think all the other networks, were just riding all night this idea that Gerald Ford, who had been president, was going to come in and be the vice president, but that he was insisting on kind of being a co-president. And this was our story all night long. And all of a sudden, I come on camera, and Walter was thinking I was going to say something completely different. He's always told what we're going to say.
Uh-huh.
I forget what I was supposed to be talking about. Right as they came to me, a lieutenant from the Reagan trailer right off the floor came running to me and gave me the story. And I went on the air and I said, I'm being told it's not going to be Ford. It's going to be George Bush. And Walter couldn't believe it. He kept challenging me. What? What are you saying? It was stunning. And I was very kind of excited about this. I've seen the tape. I'm very excitable.
Wow.
Because it was stunning.
Yeah.
It was a big surprise. Big surprise.
Yeah, and maybe this is an apocryphal story, but somewhere I had read that George H.W. Bush was fairly close physically to where you guys were, and he was still thinking that he hadn't gotten the VP spot. But I suppose
heard that story, and I I think he had been told.
I think
he knew before I knew, but I'm not sure. I never heard that story before.
Okay.
And it's not true.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with legendary broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl when we come back in 60 minutes. Oops, I mean 60 seconds. Warning, if you're drowning in debt you can't afford, do not let the credit card companies convince you that you have to pay it all back, because you don't. What the credit card companies don't want you to know is that there's actually a way to get debt-free without paying off your entire debt or going bankrupt. If you have $5,000 or more in credit card debt, you now have the right to let Credit Associates settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. They'll even show you how much money you could save. If you can't afford to pay off all your debt, don't let the credit card companies convince you that you have to. Call Credit Associates now for free information on how to get debt-free faster than you thought possible without debt consolidation or bankruptcy. Credit Associates depends on your success and offers a guarantee, so there's no risk. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. That's 1-800-500-0351. And now, back to the podcast. You also did 8 years of double duty as moderator of Face the Nation.
Now, that's true.
Conversations on Face the Nation can get particularly heated. Were there regular guests who you sort of dreaded or you found to be particularly difficult or unpleasant?
Yes. Yes. And I don't think I'm going to name names, but there were officials who came on and didn't tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a challenge for me. We didn't use the word liar back then, ever. you know, but it was awfully hard because his interviews were live to stand up to it and enforce it, you know, convey to the public mm-hmm. that what he just said isn't true. And so, and I knew that some of the things weren't true. And we had a lot of guests who came on regularly, who came on with the goal of not making any news. And if they got out without having said anything that's going to get in the paper the next day, they felt they deserved a gold star. And we had to deal with a lot of people who felt that they didn't need to be accountable for their government jobs. I had the opposite view. I think you're being paid by the American people. You have to answer the questions. And of course, I'm just the intermediary between the public and the government. And we want to know what you're doing. So it was, and a lot of officials came on to brief the public. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about the few who didn't.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say we didn't use the term liar back then. It
oh,
seems
never.
Decorum would always never. Dictate that, you know, politicians would say disingenuous or not being completely forthcoming.
Yeah.
And it seems that Donald Trump during the election kind of broke the seal on using the term liar. He used it everywhere.
Yeah.
Some may say that's the pot calling the kettle black. But how do you feel about that, that it's okay to use the term liar now?
Well, I feel that the direction, the coarseness of the public conversation has been so degraded that I'm mm-hmm. upset by it. I don't like it. I don't like it. Even I don't like it when reporters or people on cable, really, not national television, come out and say the president's a liar, mm-hmm. which they do. And it disturbs me. But I'm old-fashioned. You know, I started in doing this in 72. You can count up the years. I just think being courteous in public, showing respect, for not necessarily the person, but showing respect for the office, certainly the office of mm-hmm. the president. But I'm old-fashioned, I told you.
Well, old-fashioned or not, you came on board 60 Minutes in 1991. Was that something that you had wanted or had been working toward at that time? Or did it come as a surprise?
Well, at one point when I was covering the White House, I thought that would be a wonderful next step.
Mm-hmm.
But I came to the conclusion that Don Hewitt, who ran 60 Minutes, really didn't want me. Because
really?
I was an obvious choice. And in those days, there was a woman's chair, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was the obvious choice when Diane Sawyer left. And he didn't choose me. So I gave up the idea. I accepted that. It's not going to happen. So when he did call me, and I was stunned that he was calling me, I was thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great, wonderful, it was like the best birthday present you could ever have.
And what was the legendary Don Hewitt like? Was he a fatherly presence at 60 Minutes, or was he kind of gruff? Did he give you advice?
He was not fatherly.
Yeah.
And he wasn't gruff either. He was very high energy. He kept us on our toes. He didn't walk ever. He ran. He didn't talk ever. He yelled. And everything was straightforward. There was no indirection with him. And something that people rarely talk about. They talk about what a great showman he was. They talk about his emphasis on storytelling, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
All of us had to write well and had to develop narrative writing. So that our stories had a beginning, a middle, and end, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a terrific journalist. And that's one of the things I really respected about him. He wanted, and he agreed with me that public officials, part of their mandate is to answer questions.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, if he would say, what are you going to ask him? And he'd say, well, ask a tougher question. And I love that. About him. He also, there was never, ever a story, I'm telling you, ever a story that he didn't make better.
Really?
And I say it from my stories, but I think all the rest of us would say that too. He had an eye that was instinctive. He would say, move this, you know, the third, let's say the third chapter of your story to the beginning. And you'd say, why? That doesn't make sense. And he would not be able to tell you why. He could never say, because, you know, it would slow down. He just didn't know why.
It was just an instinct.
He knew by instinct.
Yeah.
And almost every time, not 100%, you did what he said, and you couldn't believe how much better the storytelling was. It just was, he was a genius.
When you go into an interview with whoever it is, whether it's Benjamin Netanyahu or Donald Trump, do you walk in with a ton of research under your arm, or do you try to keep a certain degree of naivete and curiosity?
I go in as well informed as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I read tons of stuff before a major interview like those.
Mm-hmm.
Tons and tons of stuff. The producers and I always work up an interview with specific questions. But the reading is important, because if the person you're talking to takes you off your track, which happens all the time, they go off on tangents, they don't answer your question specifically, but they say something really interesting that you weren't planning to talk about, but thankfully you know about because you've read about it. So you have to stay willing to go off the script and follow wherever they want to go, because if they want to talk about something, you're always going to, I think, get something a little richer, because they'll be relaxed about it. I don't want to be naive.
Yeah.
I don't think a woman should come off as naive.
Well,
what do you think I come off as naive?
Not at all.
Why did you ask that?
Well, I ask because, you know, my problem is sometimes I do so much research that I find myself regurgitating facts. Then I stop asking the questions that the average listener probably would want to know.
Oh.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Have you questions?
Yeah.
We work on our questions. I always sit down with my team in the circle. There are usually three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we work on the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we do work to ask the question everybody wants to hear. And we get rid of all the, you know, the numbers and the figures and the background in the questions. We strategize. What do we want? What do we hope that so-and-so will say?
Right.
What's our dream answer? Okay. What's the best question to get at that?
Yeah.
We do a lot of that.
And sometimes instead of a dream answer, you get a walk-off. There have been a number of guests who've notoriously done that.
I mean, when they throw their microphone down and just stomp out of the interview. That,
yeah. What do you do in that situation? Like with Sarkozy, how do you react to that?
with Sarkozy, we begged him to come back.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. But the honest truth is, when he stormed out, I said to myself, and I said to the producers, wow, we're going to have a great story.
Yeah.
You know, I just knew it was going to make our story much better. And we'd already filmed a lot with him. So.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes, now Ross Perot walked out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And really, it was kind of early in the interview.
Oh.
And we begged him to come back, and he did.
Do you usually try to figure out which questions are most likely to make someone rip their mic off and save those for the last bit then?
Oh, never.
No?
I never have ever planned a question hoping they'll walk off. Never.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I don't want them to walk off.
Right. Yeah, then there's
no story.
Although
in the Sarkozy case, I wasn't the least bit upset about it. Boris Yeltsin walked off, and I was bewildered because we had an interpreter, and I didn't understand why he was offended by my question.
Huh.
Even today, I couldn't fully explain what set him off. I think the interpreter changed the sense of what I was asking. But I don't know. I just was completely thrown back by it, bewildered. What did I say? What happened here?
Yeah. Do you remember what the question was?
It was a question about the healthcare system in the Soviet Union. And I had done a story on how woeful it was and how far behind Western medicine they were. And I asked him a question about it, and suddenly he was screaming at me about his mother. It was very peculiar.
Well, you know, since it's Boris Yeltsin, I have to wonder, do you think he was sober in that interview?
I do not think he was sober in
that
interview.
Well, there you
go. He was playing tennis. He insisted we do it on the tennis court. No, I don't think he was sober at all. But still, he was answering questions.
Right.
And
Who's been the hardest interview to get, or the one that's taken the longest to land?
Oh, gee. That's a good question. I've always wanted to interview Warren Buffett, and he still hasn't said yes about an interview for him. I interviewed his son, and he gave me an interview about his son. But I've tried for a long time to do a profile of Warren Buffett. Who did I go after, and finally said, they usually don't finally say yes. That's the problem. If they don't say yes quickly, and you keep at them, you know, it's still going to be no.
Really? But you're 60 minutes.
It's really usually CEOs and the heads of corporations.
Oh.
And they're very jittery, specifically about 60 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
And, yeah.
They know you're going to get them. Okay.
Well, they will come on if they have something to sell, and then they'll come on. But they won't do it just because they've been in the news and they're in some kind of hot water.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of times they come on thinking, well, I'll explain myself, but very rarely.
Yeah. Does anyone ever in their right mind go on to 60 Minutes thinking that they're going to be able to explain themselves adequately?
A lot. And I'll tell you something, we're as surprised as the public is.
Yeah. Well, you interviewed President Trump both during the campaign and then right after the election, I think within days of the election. Did you see a change in the man in that short period?
Well, I interviewed him 3 days after he won. And he was a totally different person than he was during the campaign and that he has been as president. And I think and I assumed at the time that he was in a state of shock. Although he says he knew he was going to win, I don't think he knew one bit because he was, when I interviewed him the first time, he leaned forward in his chair and he looked like a tiger who was about to pounce. You know, if you ask something I don't like, I'm going to go back at you. But 3 days after the election, he was really, leaning back in his chair. The answers to my questions were thoughtful. He didn't challenge the questions. He answered them as best he could. And I think the public really liked that interview because I asked serious questions. He gave serious answers.
Yeah.
It was a different man. And I thought to myself, okay, he is going to be presidential. That's it. You know, he's figured it out. We're going to see a different person. And within a couple of days, he was tweeting and kind of back to the person we'd seen before the interview.
Now, did he like the interview or was he tweeting about you the moment it aired?
No, he wasn't tweeting about me. And I think he did like the interview.
Okay.
Although he didn't call me and tell me so, but I think so. And he should. I mean, he came off as sober and thoughtful. There were a few times where he was standing, you know, fighting back, but that's what you expect in an interview.
Yeah.
And it was done respectfully on both sides, I think.
You know, these days, journalists tend to hop around between networks, cable news, new media, like they're changing socks, but you're kind of like an old school company man. You've been at CBS your whole career.
Right.
I'm sure you've had plenty of offers. Why were you never tempted away from CBS?
Well, I was the White House correspondent and did Face the Nation at the same time. And it was wonderful. I loved it. I loved my job when I was covering politics. And I would still have that job if they would keep me. But when you go to 60 Minutes, you've entered a whole different realm. It's a whole different kind of journalism. And I was older when I came here and thrilled to be given a challenge to do something completely different. When I started, it was hard for me. And it's paradise over there at 60 mm-hmm. Minutes. You know, you get to choose your own stories. You don't worry. At other outfits, you're assigned the story, and you very often end up with something you're not interested in, something you don't want to deal with. We're always interested in our stories, and we get time to tell them. We cover serious subjects, but every now and then we can go to a movie star. Who wouldn't love this job? And notice something. People stay on this job as long as they'll let us. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike into his 90s. Andy Rooney into his 90s.
Yeah.
Morley deep into his 80s. And poor both Bob Simon and Ed Bradley. You know, they literally died on the job.
I have to ask, what was Andy Rooney like? Was he as much of a curmudgeon as he seemed, or was that sort of a character for him?
No, he was a curmudgeon. There's no question. But I have to tell you, he was so wonderful to me and women, young women in general.
Yeah.
He would call and say, good story. He would come around. You know, his office was not in 60 Minutes. He didn't want to sit with us.
Oh, I didn't know that. that wasn't in the building?
He worked across the street. He worked across the street in a little office in the main CBS News building. 60 Minutes is across the street. And so he would come over once a week to show the boss what he wanted to say. You know, he would write it down and the boss would look at it and approve it, as the boss does for all our stories, by the way. And then he would kind of walk up and down Correspondent Row, where our offices are all in one row, and come in and chat with us. And very funny, very adorable, I thought. But he was, from time to time, a curmudgeon. He never, for example, would sign an autograph.
Really?
That kind of thing, yeah, yeah.
What do you think he would think about the social media age and selfies?
Oh, my goodness. Can you just, that's funny. You could just think of an Andy Rooney essay on the language that's being used on cable today. I can just hear Andy Rooney. It would be fabulous.
Well, before we go, years from now, hopefully decades from now, when CBS or 60 Minutes is assembling your in memoriam reel, what's the one piece that you'd like to
be
remembered for?
Now. What do you mean?
Well, if you can choose, what's the one piece you want to be remembered for?
I will tell you a secret, okay? When is your story going to run?
This coming Thursday, right before the first episode of 60 Minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, here's your secret. Here's your scoop. We are working on a 50th anniversary show. And some of our favorite pieces that we've done will be on the show.
Okay.
And some of mine will be on the show. I don't know which ones. I've told them my favorites, and I don't know if they're going to pick the ones I've said or other ones, and I don't know how many, but that's going to be on television. I guess I would like to be remembered for continuing to do it the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the public appreciates it. I think that I can tell by our ratings,
yeah,
and I can tell by what people say to me when I walk down the street, that they like the way we go about our journalism, and that they think we're fair, and I really try to be fair. I really work at that. So that's what I'd like to be remembered for.
Well, 60 Minutes returns for its 50th season with a special anniversary episode this Sunday, September 24th at 6, 7 Central. Leslie, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
So I want to thank you so much. This has been so fun, and I can't wait to hear how you put it together.
Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Want to try day trading markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Thanks again to Leslie Stahl for coming on the podcast. One more time, the 50th anniversary of 60 Minutes airs this Sunday, September 24th at 6, 7 Central on CBS. For more information, visit cbsnews.com and order Leslie Stahl's charming memoir, Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of New Grandparenting, on Amazon. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.